In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
It lays the predicate and the foundation for the development of a weather satellite that will permit man to determine the world's cloud layer and ultimately to control the weather, and he who controls the weather will control the world.
In this day and age, as grassroots movements become marred and battered by controlled opposition such as false revolutions, divide and conquer among race and sex, the actual engineering of climate, such as creating drought and enhancing hurricanes, remain essentially ignored by a well-funded media. Though anyone can watch video of aerosol operations being conducted in skies across the planet, with this topic in particular of climate change, global warming, geoengineering, and real-time weather control technology, there are several realities colliding into each other within the public consciousness. One of the more disappointing of these realities is the absenteeism of the so-called environmentally conscious progressive left that Vivian Workington sharply described in her article titled The Real Inconvenient Truth. Welcome to a special In Other News discussion. I'm Jeff Brady. For the next 2 hours, I'll be joined by one of the leaders in the anti-geoengineering movement who will speak in this live on-air session with a prominent climate scientist and then a professor who has been researching climate engineering potentials for more than 10 years. I'll be moderating an exchange of conflicting viewpoints on the topic of geoengineering and climate change to facilitate a better understanding of an emotionally charged and intentionally muddied topic. As many have become convinced that real-time weather climate control, known as geoengineering operations, are conducted across this planet, yet within the halls of academia and think tanks, scientists and weather experts relay to the outside world that geoengineering is not happening, but would be necessary in an emergency. Let's examine the evidence from their perspectives. Our guest is Dane Wigington, lead researcher with geoengineeringwatch.org, who claims available evidence indicates that climate engineering operations have been fully deployed. Dane has a background in solar energy and forestry health. He's focused on the climate engineering issue and says ongoing geoengineering operations have created many of the catastrophic environmental effects we witness today. In the first hour, Professor Paul Beckwith, a physicist and engineer, joins Dane in the discussion. Professor Beckwith is a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa Laboratory of Paleoclimatology and is in a PhD program with a focus on abrupt climate system change. He's also at Carleton University, Department of Geography and Environmental Studies. Mr. Beckwith does not believe global climate engineering operations have been deployed. Now, in the second hour, Dane is joined by Professor Douglas McMartin, a senior research associate and senior lecturer in mechanical and aerospace engineering at Cornell, and a research professor in computing and mathematical sciences at the California Institute of Technology. Since 2006, Professor McMartin has focused on what's termed, quote, the largest controlled problem, geoengineering. It's the idea that one might offset some of the consequences of climate change by reflecting some sunlight back to space. Now, there's a warning in this that these discussions may cause cognitive dissonance. Dane Wigington, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff.
Now, we're also joined with Paul Beckwith. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for joining us. So we can get through questions. Let's try to keep answers around 1 minute or so, if possible. Paul Beckwith, I realize you don't agree with, and there may not be any common ground here, except for that you may both agree on the idea of changing climate or a warming planet. Paul, before we begin, if you would, please tell listeners about the type of climate research that you do.
I try to look at the overall climate system and connect the dots, if you like, join the different parts. So it's clear that our greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel combustion have changed the atmosphere the chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans, specifically with the higher elevated levels of greenhouse gases. So the planet is warming, but we're losing Arctic sea ice and snow cover in the Arctic at exponential rates. So the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the planet. Because the Arctic's warming much faster, the temperature difference to the equator is reduced. So this disrupts the jet streams. The jet streams have become wavier and more persistent, getting stuck. It's also warmer, so there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. So what we're seeing with these fractured and broken jet streams is we're seeing extreme weather events accelerating around the world. We're seeing increases in severity, in duration, in intensity, and these events are happening more frequent. I'm talking about torrential rains leading to droughts or leading to floods, rather, or droughts in other regions. So we're undergoing abrupt climate change, and weather events around the world are worsening, and this is going to get even far worse as we lose Arctic sea ice and snow cover.
Okay. For the record, as we've mentioned, Paul, you don't believe that geoengineering operations have been deployed, yet you do agree that geoengineering in certain forms are necessary, and you're pushing for that. Based on your research, why do you believe geoengineering is necessary to deploy, and what types of geoengineering do you suggest?
I think we're in a global climate change emergency. The changes are happening at much faster rates than we can deal with. So what's going to happen very soon is we're going to completely lose Arctic sea ice and have a blue ocean event in the Arctic, completely open water, no ice at the end of the melt season. And then that duration of no ice is going to extend over subsequent seasons, and the weather disruptions to the jet stream because of the jet streams, et cetera, are going to get far worse. And it's going to hit the global food supply. Food prices will have problems with food supply. Food prices will spike up. That's not to mention all of the damages to infrastructure that we're seeing. So in order to deal with this emergency, we need to deal with it on an emergency basis. And I talk about a three-legged bar stool set of solutions. The first is to slash fossil fuel emissions, which is the only one really talked about by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, et cetera. We have to do that as fast as possible, but it's not sufficient. We also need to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So a whole branch of geoengineering is called carbon dioxide removal. And then another branch, so that's the second leg of the bar stool, CDR, carbon dioxide removal. The third leg is SRM, which is the focus of our show here today. We need to We need to cool the planet. We need to cool the Arctic to ensure that we don't completely lose sea ice and snow cover, try to stabilize sea level rise, et cetera. And there's many different ways of doing this. Just making the planet lighter, less dark is a key factor. So solar radiation management, one of the things that we know will work is injecting sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere will block sunlight and cool the planet quickly. We've seen this in major volcanoes that have occurred. So we can do this. These things are all technologically feasible, and we need to deploy them on an emergency basis to address the climate emergency problem.
Okay. Solar radiation management, carbon removal, decrease in production of fossil fuel. Dane, to reiterate, you do believe climate engineering, weather control technology has been fully deployed based on the research you present. Do you have a response to this question and Paul's answer?
I do. First, I would ask your listeners, Jeff, to not believe anything I say. I ask them to investigate what I'm stating, because we have mountains of climate data, NASA images, film footage to prove absolutely positively that climate engineering has been deployed since probably 1945. I refer to government documents, Senate documents, again, film footage. So I would have a question for Mr. Beckwith, if he might answer this question after I elaborate. If on climate engineering, Paul, I'll address this for the listeners as well. When we have NASA, for example, stating on the record that the condensation trails, which they call condensation, are actually heating the atmosphere, we have NOAA stating on the record that the atmospheric particulates, Paul, from 2000 to 2010 doubled, and they don't know where it's coming from. When we have global dimming already, that's at 20 to 30%. That's 20 to 30% of the sun's direct rays that are no longer reaching the surface of the planet. When we have, again, film footage of aircraft with nozzles mounted on them aimed into the exhaust jet stream, we have photographs of aircraft interiors with tanks on the inside. We have the exact elements named in climate engineering patents, of which we have about 160-plus logged at geoengineeringwatch.org. The exact elements from those patents are coming down through our breathable air column, starting with aluminum, barium, strontium. What I would say is this, Jeff, that with 70 years of ongoing climate engineering, we know absolutely positively that it is not only not a cure, it is a curse worse than the disease itself. And everything we see, for your listeners to understand and verify, every single consequence that is acknowledged by the climate science community that we will face if we climate engineer, we already have. We have a totally disrupted hydrological cycle. We have an ozone layer that is not recovering. It's not only not recovering, it's continuing to disintegrate. And we have the exact same elements raining down through the air column that are listed on climate engineering patents. And in the case of 70 lab tests in the western U.S. and California alone, showing unimaginable quantities of aluminum as a primary element and barium. And we have studies from, for example, CARB, California Air Resources Board, that study the aerosols from China that everybody wants to point to as a source of these contaminants, stating that metals like aluminum and barium are not amongst those contaminants. So it's a localized source for these. And we have, again, solar obscuration, exactly what solar radiation management calls for, is occurring, Jeff, and that's what got me into this battle to begin with. I have a background in solar, was losing immense amount of my solar power, something that people like Paul don't consider when they talk about blocking the sun with reflective toxic aerosols. And because I was losing so much solar power, that's what, again, started me researching this issue, and after enough lab tests realizing and enough research realizing that this was absolutely positively going on. It's indisputable.
Paul, do you have a response to Dane right now?
Yeah, Dane's mostly mixing up climate and weather. He's mostly talking about weather modification experiments that have been done. There's some very, excellent books on this, on some of the things that have been done, for example, with silver iodide seeding clouds.
We're talking about aluminum, Paul, not silver.
Yeah, well, aluminum. One of the problems is, we have techniques to do spectroscopic analysis of soil that are far more sensitive than things that we've had, even 10 years ago. So we can examine.
We're not talking about soil.
You were talking about contamination of soil. You brought up so many different
precipitation
points.
Precipitation contamination. We're not talking about soils, not at all, not in any way, shape, or form. We're talking about contamination in the rain.
Okay.
Right, which ends up in the soils, and you measure it in the soils, right? You're talking about experiments extracting raindrops and measuring what's inside the raindrops. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right. Okay. So first of all, we're an industrial society, okay? We have smokestacks all around the planet from heavy industry spewing out toxins.
I addressed that, Paul. We have CARB studies proving it's not coming. We have no industry west of us, none, until Asia, China.
Dane, hold on a second. Hold on just a minute, guys. Let me just say, Dane, let Paul finish.
If I can speak a few sentences.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Our measurement techniques are far more sensitive today than they were even a decade or two ago. So we're able to measure hundreds and hundreds of chemicals at part per trillion levels in some cases, very, very low levels. And we can measure the blood, we can measure raindrops, we can measure soil particles, we can measure any substance in small quantities and find out what all the different chemical components are in. And we find, of course, a smorgasbord of elements. And to say that they're all because of something, some spraying or something, is absurd in my opinion. There's multiple sources from these things. The aerosol increases since 2000 that Dane was talking about is huge increases in industrial pollution, of course, from China. China was building an extra a new coal plant every week or so. There's all kinds of crap in coal, stuff that you dig out of the ground, like coal. So we get these trace elements all over the place. So to attribute them to industry around the planet is correct, but to attribute them to some spraying in the atmosphere, which no scientists agree with Dane. I shouldn't say no. There's probably a few. Listen, I went to the American Geophysical Union conference in December in New Orleans. It's one of the largest earth science conferences in the world. I didn't see Dane or anybody there. In fact, there was not a single word mentioned in the entire curriculum on chemtrails or on geoengineering with the idea of spraying chemicals in the air that is being done for, 40,000 scientists and engineers from mostly U.S. An enormous conference, 54 parallel sessions of talks. So you couldn't just go to one talk. There were 54 sessions in parallel, poster sessions. Nothing was mentioned about chemtrails. You can't find it.
Paul,
no scientists
let me jump
agree
in.
That
Paul,
this is happening.
Paul,
yes.
Paul, let go me ahead. Jump in. I understand the point about it wasn't mentioned, and I hear what you're saying there, although that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't exist.
I agree.
Exactly.
Okay.
I want to clear that one.
If I can elaborate, Paul, to before you get too far down the road, first, on the chemtrails term, we're not talking about chemtrails. We don't talk about that at geoengineeringwatch.org. So in regard to that term, let me refer to a survey done by Carnegie Science in which 16% of 450 scientists surveyed denied chemtrails. But they weren't asked about geoengineering, solar radiation management, stratospheric aerosol injection. When those same 77 scientists were asked on the record by our legal team if geoengineering, climate engineering, solar radiation management had been deployed and if they were willing to deny that deployment on the record, none of those 77 scientists was then willing to deny that climate engineering had been deployed. And we surveyed another 1,430 scientists on top of those 77. So we had 1,500 scientists, none of whom were willing to deny that climate engineering had already been deployed, not chemtrails. So we're not talking about chemtrails. In regards to the particulate you're talking about, Paul, we're talking about escalations in those particulates, in some cases in single rain events, 50,000% increase, and we know it's not coming from China. That's what I tried to state on the phone a moment ago. We have CARB studies, California Air Resource Board studies, that prove these particulates are not coming from China. They're new. They're of recent origin, if you will, and so much particulate matter has fallen, it has changed soil pH values 10 to 12 times toward alkaline. This is not industrial pollution. We have the CARB studies to prove that. So my question to you, Paul, if we have so much aluminum raining down through our air column, and that's a primary element on climate engineering patent, we have global dimming that we know is the goal of climate engineering, why in the world would I think, or any rational person who examines this issue in the historical data, why would we think that our government would ask our permission before they would deploy these programs? I'm asking you. Why would we think this is anything other than what all available evidence appears it is?
Well, it's the wrong substances, for one thing, that you're talking about. That we have to have a really stupid government if they're spraying aluminum substances. If the government wanted to if they were concerned about climate change being an emergency and they wanted to covertly do something about it, then we wouldn't be sitting at 1.2, 1.4 degrees above pre-industrial right now. Our temperatures globally would be sitting close to what they were pre-industrially because sulfate spraying in the upper atmosphere would cool the planet. We know. I mean, when there's a large volcano going off and it's injecting ash and chemicals into the upper atmosphere, into the stratosphere, it cools the planet. The reflectivity, the transmission of the atmosphere changed from a nominal 92-93% transmission as measured in Mauna Loa, where we measure the greenhouse gases we have since the late 50s. It's during these volcanoes, it's dropped to about 80, so it went down from about 93% transmission to about 82%, 80% in the case of El Chichen, about 92% in the case of Pinatubo. So if we wanted to cool the planet, we could cool the planet using geoengineering. And this would be spraying sulfur in the upper atmosphere, small amounts, in fact, smaller amounts than we put out from any coal-burning power plant into the lower atmosphere. And we would cool the planet. We would see this happening, and it doesn't happen. So why would they be using something that doesn't work to cool the planet? Obviously, it doesn't work. If they've been doing this for years and years, it doesn't work. We're warming, and the extreme weather events are taking off around the planet. So why would they go and deploy something that isn't going to work? It's aluminum compounds.
Okay.
It wouldn't work.
If I can answer that before you get too far,
Paul,
I mean,
Paul, let Dane answer that. Go ahead, Dane.
Before you get too far down the road, first, Paul, again, to refer to what I stated earlier in the conversation, they did deploy in 1945, and it did have an initial cooling effect before the negative effects kicked in. And anybody who looks at a temperature graph will see a very unexplainable sharp decline in global temperatures from 1945 to about 1975, so much so that climate scientists were scratching their heads wondering how it could still be cooling when all indications should be that it was warming. We have NOAA, the article I just referred to, in 2011, stating, your listeners can look this up, Jeff, that there was an unexplained massive increase in aerosols in the stratosphere that were, in fact, cooling the planet to a degree if we don't take into account the negative consequences, destroying the ozone layer and completely disrupting the hydrological cycle, which, Paul, when you refer to climate engineering as a cure, because we're mimicking volcanoes, volcanoes have the same effect. They destroy the ozone layer and they disrupt the hydrological cycle along with a lot of other downstream effects. Now we're talking about aluminum. Aluminum is the primary patent in climate engineering, or primary element in climate engineering patents, Paul, like stratospheric Welsbach seeding for reduction of global warming. It's the primary element named by David Keith in international geoengineering seminars as a desired element. Why? Because its reflectivity, you referred to making the planet more reflective, and its lack of coagulation. The particles don't clump together with no apparent concern for the toxicity. When you refer to the government as they wouldn't do this because they're not, in your words, stupid, I wouldn't even want to go down that road, Paul. How many things does the government do that would fit into that category, like detonating 2,000 nuclear bombs, which contaminated everyone on the planet? So, again, I don't think any of those arguments hold up. We have film footage of aircraft with nozzles spraying at altitude. We have tests on the ground showing the primary element in climate engineering patents. And a final question, Paul. If we have the U.S. military stating on the record, and they have, your listeners can look this up, Jeff, the climate disintegration is the greatest national security threat of all. Paul, my question to you is, do you think they would ask our permission before they did this?
No, I don't think they necessarily would. But, I mean, you're saying this has been ongoing since the war, basically, Second World War. Like, what's the point? Nobody was worried about climate change back then. So you're what's the reason? Who's they doing it? Are you talking about the U.S. military? Like, are you saying that this is going on globally, but it's your they is never defined, right? Like this, the point is nobody agrees with you, Dane. No scientists agree with you. Like, you've got these ideas about what's happening. Let me ask you one question. Just say yes or no. Are fossil fuel emissions that are producing, you know, that are resulting in CO2, methane, nitrous oxide levels increasing quite rapidly in the atmosphere, are they causing warming of our planet? Are they causing climate change? Yes or no?
I have never said otherwise. Of course they are. How could they not be? And Paul, when you say that nobody's been worried about this or they weren't worried about this then, I would refer, Jeff, your listeners to, for example, publications like Popular Science and Collier's Magazine from the 50s, stating then that the planetary warming was already at 2 degrees Fahrenheit and that climate engineering could rectify that. We published these articles. I have original copies in my possession. They were absolutely worried about it then, and to say that they weren't, Paul, is not factual.
What,
they
what
were
about
absolutely
the,
concerned.
Was it warming or cooling? I thought a lot of right-wing talk shows and think tanks and so on say that scientists thought we're worried about cooling in the 70s, global cooling. You can't have both ways. Was it warming or cooling that you're talking about?
I don't know why you're putting me in that right-wing think
tank.
No, I have nothing to do with
listen,
that. So,
listen,
and I just explained,
I just
explained, Paul, that I just answered that question. When they deployed in 45, the temperature graph that was going straight up in 1945 unexplainably dropped and leveled off for 30 years. By the mid-70s, the climate science community, about 20% of them, were very perplexed at what was happening. They didn't know geoengineering was going on, and they were perplexed that the temperature had leveled off for 30 years because of geoengineering. But that card has been played, and your statement that as if we have this option still, and it hasn't been going on for 70 years already, by governments to do whatever they want, whenever they want, is simply not backed up by the facts, Paul.
Okay, so do you think we're in a global climate change emergency that was caused First of all, yeah, do you think we're in a global climate change emergency because of the extreme weather? Like, extreme weather events are clearly on the rise. Torrential rains leading to floods, massive insurance damages, much stronger hurricanes because the oceans are warmer, changes in the global circulation patterns, like the jet streams breaking up and becoming slower and wavier, and are all these events occurring today? Is this do you think this warrants a global emergency? And see, you're attributing these things to one thing, and I'm attributing them to something else. But can we agree?
Wait a minute. When did I attribute them to one thing?
Hold on,
Dane.
Let
me stop you there. Want to stop you there.
Continue on. Spraying and chemicals.
Paul, you asked a number of...
I'm trying to find common ground. I'm just trying to find some common ground.
I think there is common ground between you. And let's take one of those questions.
Didn't want him to get too far down the road, that's all, Jeff. I wanted to answer those.
Understood. So, Dane, what do you attribute the climate change elements to? And we'll start with that question.
I just want to answer you in that, Paul, because, of course, I understand all of those factors. I did lectures on climate change before I focused all on climate engineering, because it was the superseding threat, even worse than climate change itself, which is caused by countless forms of anthropogenic activity. All forms of anthropogenic activity, I think you and I would agree, are a form of climate engineering, anything that affects the energy balance of the planet. And yes, we face something that is
change, right? It's not engineering, something you do intentionally, isn't it? Like, I have an engineering degree, so let's the word is important, okay? We screwed up the planet, not intentionally, I would argue. Like, the fossil fuel emissions are a side effect of industrial civilization, right? And they've changed the atmosphere, the chemistry, and the oceans. They're becoming acidic. This isn't engineering. This wasn't intended. This was a side effect of industrial civilization. Is that... Sorry,
but the net effect is the same.
Right?
That's my only point. The net effect is the same.
Right.
We're altering
yes.
the energy balance of the planet.
Right.
This is where, again, what we face is far worse than anything Mr. Gore has stated. This is an abrupt climate shift. We fully agree. And based on that simple premise, and militaries around the globe stating on the record they consider this the greatest threat of all, they have known this, absolutely known this, since the 40s or earlier. Why in the world we think they wouldn't deploy? We have a record, Paul. We have Project Storm
I don't think they've
Fury.
Known it since the 40s. Yeah, I disagree. Historical data states so.
It's not a question. It's not my opinion.
We're talking about weather modification experiments that were done since the 40s. You're not talking about... Nobody was trying to change the climate of the whole planet in the 40s. They were trying to make rain one place and stop rain in another place. Things like that. And, you know, how many patents are there in the world? There's gazillions of patents. How many actually come to fruition and are used? You know, it's a small fraction of it. So there's, large corporations, they get their engine. There's a whole patent office and they push people, engineers and scientists saying, you know, they try to follow their work and anything that might be novel, they try to put a patent on it. Okay, so the idea that there's patents on, you can find patents on just about anything you want to. I mean, they exist.
Let's forget
there's
the
millions
patents. Let's talk about historical data. Data that states clearly the U.S. military, U.S. government, and other scientists were absolutely concerned about the rapidly warming planet in the 40s and earlier. We have publications like, again, Popular Science, Colliers. We have original copies. We posted those. We have copies of the actual pages of the articles stating that concern in the 50s. And we have a temperature graph that unexplainably dipped right when historical documents state these programs were deployed first over the polar regions.
Every single dot connects, Paul. Okay, I have to completely – we can agree to disagree on this point. We were worried during the Cold War, we were worried about nuclear bombs taking out civilization. We were worried about nuclear accidents. We were worried about the Cubans putting missiles in Cuba, aiming them at the U.S., the missile crisis, we're worried about those things. People weren't worried. Nobody was worried about climate change at that point.
Was not worried about the changing climate going back that far.
In fact, people, were they worried about warming or cooling? Or I'm confused still on that, because there's a lot of arguments that said in the 70s, scientists were very concerned about climate cooling. And now they're worried about warming, and they were wrong before, and so why do you trust them now, right? But this is sort of the line of argument that goes. So,
just please quote me correctly, Paul. What I stated was that they didn't know why the planet had not continued at the sharp pace of warming. It had leveled off, and they didn't know why. That didn't mean their concerns about the buildup of greenhouse gases went away. It did not go away. Again, Paul, we have a Senate document from 1978, 800 pages long. I'd encourage your readers to look at, Jeff. It's posted at geoengineeringwatch.org. And in that document, it outlines the full scope and scale of the programs at that time, with budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars, outlining 10 federal agencies, 12 major universities, stating in the document that everyone involved with these programs had to have blanket legal immunity, stating in the document that normally adversarial countries, i.e. Russia, China, and the rest, would cooperate on these programs because of the cross-border ramifications. Paul, we're talking about historical documents, Senate documents.
Yeah, that's the Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, U.S. Senate, May 1978, Chapter 5, Federal Activities and Weather Modification. And the first
weather modification, yes.
Yeah, the first
climate ever mentioned there.
On a global scale, Paul.
Well, the first paragraph
okay.
is, the federal government has been involved for over 30 years in a number of aspects of weather modification through activities of both the Congress and executive branch. Since 1947, weather modification bills pertaining to research, support, operation, policy studies, regulations, liabilities, mm-hmm. activity reporting.
Okay.
It's just another sentence here.
Yeah,
establishment.
That's interesting. Physics guy. I'll read this now.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for pointing it out to
Absolutely,
me.
Absolutely, yeah.
I know lots of work has been done in all kinds of different areas. You know, a lot of it doesn't come up for public consumption, right, until years later.
Yeah, right. Dane, how did you come across this?
I found it on the NASA archives.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Do you guys want to keep going on this, the history of weather control and the warming or cooling, or do you want to move on to another topic?
If I could ask Paul a question, though, Paul, if you could elaborate on why you feel, now this is a form of geoengineering that most of your listeners might not be aware of, Paul. It's called, Jeff, it's called ocean iron fertilization, and the process is to put materials into the ocean that will cause algae or plankton blooms and thus absorb CO2 in the oceans and take it out of the atmosphere. Paul, can you explain why you think that's a good thing? And I'll explain after why I think it's absolutely not a good thing.
I think we're in a climate emergency. I think that the course that we're going on now, we're going to lose the ice in summers. Extreme weather events are going to skyrocket at least 10, 20, 30, 40 times what we have now. Cities are going to drop. Countries are going to go bankrupt. We're going to have hits to global food supply, and food prices will spike, and this will, you know, we have huge geopolitical unrest and problems. And I think that's where we're heading. You know, that's the risk. So the risk of doing nothing is what I just described. So we need to, as I said, we need to slash fossil fuels. We need to do CDR and SRM. Part of CDR, carbon dioxide removal, is trying to figure out ways to actually actively remove CO2 from the atmosphere. There's about a dozen startups that are looking at direct air capture. There's other groups that are looking at ways to store carbon in soils, like biochar ideas. Stopping the destruction of rainforests, for example, is one big way. You know, these are carbon sinks. The things on the planet that capture carbon need to be enhanced and increased, not destroyed. The oceans are barren. Most of the oceans are barren. There's no life at the surface. If you go to coastlines, you get proliferation of life. That's where all the fishing occurs because you get upwelling of water, cold water. That water has nutrients. Phytoplankton need sunlight. They need nutrients. The nutrients are from below. There's a lack of nutrients, especially in the southern ocean. So if we provided iron, which is a trace element in the water, it's one of the limiting nutrients, and we can get proliferation of phytoplankton. The zooplankton eat them. We can get a revival of the proliferation of marine life in the oceans, and that sucks up carbon from the atmosphere. And that carbon ends up in the deep ocean floor sediments where it's brought out of the atmosphere ocean system. I think the potential of withdrawing huge amounts of carbon from the atmosphere quickly are very, very good in the oceans. That's why I think we need to do this.
Dang. If I could respond, first of all, I want to state this. We are completely on the same page in regard to the severity of what's unfolding in regard to the ramifications of what will likely be a blue ocean event this year or next, and the bleak horizon that we face. We are completely on the same page. What I am arguing, Paul, is that climate engineering takes us out of the frying pan and puts us in the fire. And governments around the globe made this decision without public knowledge or consent. They committed us to an experiment for which there is no return. And sometimes doing nothing is better than doing something that makes it worse. In regard to ocean fertilization, Paul, we would agree, you would agree, the oceans are acidifying. We know this without any ambiguity, correct? The oceans are absolutely acidifying right now. So if we force the oceans by iron fertilization to absorb even more CO2, and I would argue that's already going on, that the SRM materials being used over the oceans are also being used when they hit the sea surface as ocean fertilization materials. And what are we seeing around the globe? Massive dead zones, hypoxic and anoxic, low and no oxygen zones appearing all over the globe. We have marine life dying everywhere. The ocean is acidifying at blinding speed. It's killing organisms from the top of the food chain to the bottom. What happens when we force the ocean to absorb even more CO2? I agree with you that industrialized civilization must stop. But if we intervene in a way that makes the problem far worse and not better, how are we helping? How are we helping the situation and forcing the oceans to become even more acidic? We have scientists around the globe now sounding the alarm at the acidifying oceans, and you're suggesting that we make them even more acidic.
No, I'm not suggesting that we make them more acidic. It's the exact opposite. The CO2,
if they absorb CO2, how can they not be more acidic?
Well, it depends on what form the carbon's in, of course. If it's CO2 in the atmosphere, in raindrops, it becomes carbonic acid. In the ocean, it becomes carbonic acid at the surface. What phytoplankton do is they remove the CO2 from the seawater, making it less acidic. So the CO2 goes into their bodies. It's not sitting in the water as carbonic acid. The dead zones in the ocean are almost exclusively in shallow water, like, for example, the Gulf of Mexico. So if you get phytoplankton blooms on the surface, then as these phytoplankton are eaten by zooplankton or die, if they're eaten and excreted, or if they're eaten and the organism dies, or they die directly as the plant material, they sink to the bottom, they're consumed by bacteria, which uses up all the oxygen, creating the oxygen-free, the dead zones. And it's in shallow water. The thing is we stimulate these phytoplankton blooms in the deep ocean. So we don't get a dead zone issue. All of the detritus from the dead organic matter sinks to the ocean floor and is captured in sediments in the deep ocean floor. It doesn't create dead zones. It's totally, completely different. And it reduces the CO2 that's in solution in the oceans, reducing the pH, and it's capturing CO2 out of the atmosphere, and the oceans are dying. We've lost 90% of the large fish in the ocean. Phytoplankton levels are down in the last three or four decades. We know that a study just came out, it was published just in the last week, talking about one of the mechanisms of higher CO2 in the atmosphere. It prevents the phytoplankton from absorbing the iron property that they need. So the phytoplankton are suffering immensely from acidic oceans. It's not just the shellfish. So anything that can cause phytoplankton to proliferate will then cause zooplankton to proliferate all the way up the food chain, and we can restore ocean health and make it a big, huge carbon sink, which, this is biomimicry. This is just trying to help nature do something that it's been doing for a long time. Instead of trying to destroy nature and always working against nature, all I'm talking about is being smart about this and looking at methods to get nature to help us, to help nature, to push it along. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Dan.
I encourage your listeners to read a published report on geoengineeringwatch.org called More Mass Failure of Geoengineering, Ocean Fertilization Can't Work. This is from a published scientific study, and here's one of the excerpts from the study. Scientists plumbing the depths of the central equatorial Pacific have found that ancient sediments suggesting that one proposed way to mitigate climate engineering, ocean fertilization, can't work as envisioned. Can't, as in won't. We know this already. We know this. When you interfere with nature, this is no different than GMO crops.
Wait a second. I'd like to see 10 studies on this. If this is something that can work for us, I don't care about
it's been
one
done.
Study. You shouldn't either, right? I mean, studies are studies, right? Let's have a look
okay,
at.
So now we're
going to
ignore the
by,
science on this.
No, we're saying that because one study says something, and if it hasn't been confirmed by multiple other studies, and it actually works in practice. Okay, some
okay,
iron.
Let's forget
120
the study.
Well, tons, 120 tons of iron sulfate was dumped off Vancouver Island. It caused a proliferation of phytoplankton, a proliferation of zooplankton, as measured by satellite. And salmon runs were predicted to be something like 50,000 salmon running up the rivers off Canada, and they were 400,000 for the next 2 or 3 years. It just blew away the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in Canada. You know, there's lots of studies that show it will work. There's lots of studies that show that it won't work. You and I are arguing, you know, one specific thing. If this has any potential of sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere in vast amounts, it's something we can't just discount it because
okay, you just
you, know,
confirmed,
you find
though,
a study
just Paul, wait a minute. You just confirmed that I stated at the beginning of this conversation, if we take more CO2 out of the atmosphere and put it in the oceans, that will increase the acidity. Now we have the food chain collapsing on the West Coast. I think you'll acknowledge that. We have not only
wait,
the salmon
wait,
collapsing,
wait, it,
we
it,
have the,
it, it
the
depends.
Bait fish collapsing. Wait a minute, but you just stated that something
no.
in the beginning of the conversation that you seem to not acknowledge that more CO2 out of the atmosphere into the ocean will increase ocean acidity and thus will decimate
actually,
the food chain,
if,
and that's what we see happen.
Wait,
Dane,
wait a second.
Let me just jump in, Paul, if I might jump in,
yeah.
Dane. If I heard correctly, I think Paul was saying there was a transmutation of carbon from its original form, and it wouldn't necessarily contribute to acidity. Is that true?
No,
there's no
yes,
study to prove
exactly
that that's there's only studies to prove that that will not work, and this is what we see
happening
in the oceans right now.
We know what photosynthesis. That's how plants operate. Okay, the plants on land, they have stomata. They take up water, carbon dioxide through the little pores in the leaves. Through photosynthesis, light's available. Chemical reactions, it converts the carbon into chains of sugars, which are making up the organic material, the mass of the plant. Animals eat the plants and that carbon goes into them and their bodies grow and so on. All I'm saying is that in the ocean, the CO2 that goes into the ocean, yes, it causes carbonic acid, which lowers the pH. But when there's proliferation of phytoplankton, they remove the carbon dioxide from the water and it's incorporated into these sugars and chains in their bodies, allowing them to grow. And if they're eaten by larger creatures and so on, all the way up the food chain, that carbon is removed from the atmosphere, from the ocean system. It goes into the organic matter of life. And now when that life dies, if that carbon in excrement or dead organic matter sinks to the ocean floor, it's then captured into the sediment and it stays there for a long time. It's removed from the ocean atmosphere system. So proliferation of life in the ocean will reduce the pH of the ocean. It'll make the oceans a much larger sink. This has happened all through the history of life on our planet.
Okay, Paul, let me jump in for a minute.
We'll reduce the pH. That's exactly what we don't want to have happen, Paul. Let me read from the study, word for word, to refute
no,
what
no,
you just stated. This is from the study, but the researchers in the new study...
Reducing pH is less... It reduces the CO2 in the water. So
if you said reducing pH,
that's exactly what
we don't want to have happen.
Okay.
Let me read from the study real quick. If I can read one.
The acidity. You're right. I shouldn't have said pH.
Okay. He made a mistake, Dane. So he meant to say.
He meant to say the acidity.
Okay.
Which increases the pH. The open ocean is about 8.2. Right now it's dropped to about 8.05 or something. The oceans are about 30% more acidic. So we want to
let me read what the study states.
Or increase the pH. Yeah,
okay. I understand.
Go ahead, Dan.
If I can finish an excerpt from the study in question, that although some researchers believe that the ocean iron fertilization would help drop the CO2, this is what the study says about that. But the researchers in the new study, I'm reading verbatim, say that increased algae growth, which is what we're talking about in one area due to ocean iron fertilization, can inhibit growth elsewhere. This is because ocean waters are always on the move, and algae also need other nutrients such as nitrates and phosphates. Given heavy doses of iron, algae in one region may suck up all those other nutrients by the time the water circulates elsewhere. and has little more to offer. And adding iron doesn't do anything. The study appears today in the leading journal of Nature. This is a major study saying that although you might suck up some carbon in one place, it causes disruptions all through the chain that are highly negative. Just like the notion that spraying reflective particulates in the atmosphere to lower daytime temperatures has such a radical downstream effect that the catastrophic side effects are exponentially worse than what it claims to cure. And Paul, in regard to weather manipulation, weather warfare is a historical fact. And we have countries around the globe that have been engaged in weather warfare, historical fact, from the 40s on. So what I'm saying is, when we see what we see in the sky, it's blocking the sun. That's my background in the solar industry, was blocking whatever these aircraft are emitting was blocking, in some days, 80 to 90% of my solar power uptake. Are you telling me that that's condensation that can block 80% of my solar power uptake? Are you telling me that?
How many planes are in the sky now compared to 10 years ago?
Until 2015, there was a reduction in air traffic, Paul. A reduction. Until 2015, there was a reduction in air traffic.
There was some reduction. There was some reduction from the recession in North America, yes, but globally, there's far more planes flying right now. I mean, the prices are so cheap. And there's the atmosphere, we've warmed the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, and the actual upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, has cooled. Okay, the stratosphere has cooled. So the warming of the lower atmosphere greatly increases the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. Okay, when we get these large, massive storms, they inject some of this water vapor high up into the top of the troposphere, the lower atmosphere. Some of it goes into the stratosphere. That water vapor is up there. And, you know, we have planes crisscrossing the sky everywhere, and the jet engine exhaust is hot, and it holds a lot of water from the combustion process. You get water produced also, and that water leaves, and these large contrails that crisscross the sky.
Can I respond now, Jeff, to that?
Yes.
Can I respond before we get too far down the road?
Yeah,
Paul, here's an article from 2014 from Forbes. Declining humidity, atmospheric humidity, is defying global warming models. Yes, a warming climate must have more moisture in the atmosphere, more relative humidity, 7% per degree C of warming. How can it be dropping? Because there's an element that's not being acknowledged. That element is climate engineering. In regard to the engines involved, Paul, we're talking about, as you increase altitude, humidity goes down. We're talking about a high bypass turbofan jet engine, of which 85% of the air that passes through it is non-combusted. We have film footage, Paul, of what the science community is pretending is condensation being turned on and off. Now, you can't turn condensation on and off. And I'm challenging listeners to simply look at the film footage we have. We have photographs of the nozzles mounted on the pylons aimed into the exhaust jet stream and film footage of these being turned on and off. And, Paul, World War II, the B-17s that left the massive trails in spots, guess what? We have film of those that we found in the historical archives being turned on and off, indicating clearly some form of weather modification was likely going on then.
Well, sure. Well, you can see, you can go to an air show and you can see them turn on, parachute jumpers turning on smoke.
And that's a particulate.
Turning it off.
Is that not a particulate?
Like that. Well,
can we clarify though? That's a particulate.
Turn it on, but you're saying this is globally being deployed, which I say is complete nonsense. Of course, there's things that we can do on a small scale at an air show or on
it's
a,
not
over
what I'm
a particular
saying, Paul.
Region.
I'm offering,
like I'm just arguing. I mean, I think scientists have been totally negligent in addressing you and the things that you're saying, either, supporting them as you would hope or disproving them as you would argue vehemently against. It used to be okay for people to do that. It used to be okay for scientists to sit in their labs and just do their own specialized research. And we're a world of specialists. But with the web and social media and the ability to transfer ideas widespread, scientists are finally slowly waking up to the fact that they actually have to stand up and speak and actually go on radio and talk about points and argue things. And there's nowhere near enough. Let me ask you this. How many scientists will agree to have a debate with you, Dane, about about these topics. Almost none, I would argue.
Well,
right? Because it just becomes a yelling show on a radio station.
No. We are getting through some topics here, Paul, and it's not, we need much more time. I totally agree.
But what I'm saying is scientists have been awful. They didn't understand the power of social media. So now they come to, if you talk to people that have been studying geoengineering, like David, you've talked to David Keith, I'm on news, Stephen Salter is talking about marine cloud brightening, you know, spraying seawater into the lower atmosphere over the oceans to create low-level marine clouds to cool the planet. You know, if clouds are high up, they can actually warm the planet. If they're very low to the ground, they cool the planet. It depends on the altitude of the clouds as to whether they warm or cool. But the point is there's all kinds of information out there that scientists could contribute to, and they're writing books. They're starting to get more active because they realize that with abrupt climate change, we're heading into a climate emergency. So now you'll start seeing some mainstream articles come out about, okay, can we cool the Arctic? Can we cool the planet so that we can slash fossil fuel emissions?
Okay,
right?
Paul,
can
I respond? Paul, let Dane respond, please.
First, Paul, I do appreciate that you were willing to participate in this conversation. I do appreciate that. And in regard to the scope and scale this has gone, again, I don't refer anybody to my opinion. I asked them to look at Senate documents from 1978, a presidential document I also found and posted from 1966 that outlined the scope and scale of the programs even then, budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The Senate document, it actually states the agencies, universities involved, countries around the world. I'm asking people to look at the data involved with this, Paul. That's what I'm asking. So in what you're describing, marine cloud brightening and solar radiation management, everything you describe, we see it's happening. I'm asking people to look at the data, look up, and why in the world, when we know governments would never ask our permission, when we know they have known this is the greatest national security threat, when we have Senate documents, presidential documents, we have film footage, nozzles, patents, interior films, interior photos of tanks filling planes that are clearly used for some sort of aerosol dispersion. Every single dot connects here, Paul, and what I'm saying is I'm asking you and the rest of the climate...
Where's all the money coming from to do this?
Let me answer that question. The Pentagon is missing, officially, almost $9 trillion since 1996, I believe. That's what we know about, $9 trillion. So, yes, I can answer that question. Absolutely can answer it.
So what's the objective is to stop global warming? Is that what you're saying?
Saying that's certainly the stated objective, but Paul, let me ask you this. Do you think it's a coincidence, for example, when we have stated in the articles I cited earlier, in the 50s, Popular Science and Collier stating that the climate engineering could be used to shut off rainfall. 1 week after 9/11, I want to weave this into something that is relevant, so bear with me. 1 week after 9/11, Wesley Clark was told which Middle Eastern countries would be toppled and destabilized. Every single one of those countries, every single one, underwent a once-in-1,000-year drought before they were destabilized. And we have the leaders of some of those countries, like Iran, on the floor of the UN, your listeners can watch this online, stating that NATO was cutting off their rainfall. This is a weapon of war, Paul, nothing less. And it's incredibly well documented that that's what it's being used for, in addition to trying to mask the true state of climate implosion from the population until the last possible moment. It's not a cure.
Okay, so the one question. A main observation I make is how much stuff do you have about greenhouse gases on your website causing climate change? It seems to me that your oil companies and their emissions, fossil fuel emissions, have changed the chemistry of our atmosphere and oceans and are causing a
climate
emergency and all the rest of it. It seems to me like you're trying to invoke climate engineering as intentionally screwing up our weather and planet, therefore taking any onus off of the responsibility to fossil fuel companies.
Absolutely not. I am absolutely not saying that.
If I was a fossil fuel company executive, wanting to throw more doubt into the climate research and stuff, I would want to fund I would want to fund the idea of chemtrails. I would want to fund the idea that solar cycle changes are causing extreme weather. I would want to find the idea that a polar shift is causing extreme weather events around the planet.
Paul,
I would
want
to
find
every possible thing to deflect and diffuse and confuse the public.
That has nothing to do with me.
I would say be very, very careful about what you're doing, because if you're trying to bring the onus on fossil fuel companies for changing the chemistry of the atmosphere and the oceans, causing a climate emergency, to saying this is all planned and intended all along, then this is I don't understand. Like, how could you have kids? Do you have kids that you care about on the planet? Like,
yeah,
we're both
Paul,
trying to find
the
truth here.
You're going a complete different direction. I stated
lectures. We're trying to find the truth of the matter here. We agree that weather and climate is completely screwed up, but we're attributing it to totally different things. And what I'm saying we need to do as part of the solution, you're saying is already being done and is causing the problem. Like, I think
Jeff, I need to stop right there.
Go ahead, Paul.
I never
ahead, Dane.
Said that was the cause of the problem, Paul. I'm asking you to listen to what I'm saying. I'm saying that's making an already horrific problem far worse still, not better. So please don't accuse me of blaming everything on climate engineering when I already told you that I lectured on climate change before I believed the math indicated climate engineering was an even more immediate issue because it was hampering the planet's ability to respond to the anthropogenic damage done. I acknowledged that to you already. So please don't accuse me of negating the endless list of anthropogenic forms of damage to the planet. Please don't put those words in my mouth because I didn't say them.
That's clear.
But you're
that
not
clear?
Talking about them at all. But you're not talking about them. You're
emphasizing
completely different things. Right?
I'm not here to talk about that. We're tired of talk about climate engineering. We're putting 100 million tons of CO2 in the atmosphere a day. We have methane filling that. I talk about this all the time, but here's my point. Trying to intervene in these systems has made the problem worse, not better. That's my point. And we know the military is very, very good at making things worse, not better.
Paul, I'm sorry to interrupt here. We only have a minute left, so we got to wrap this up.
30 seconds each.
Okay, go ahead, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, so I would argue that we're doing – if governments are indeed trying to address climate change with climate engineering already ongoing, they're doing it completely wrong. They need to start just putting sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere, for example, to cool the planet. It is way cheaper, way easier, way less expensive. We know that volcanoes do it. So why would we bother with any other substances, aluminum, barium, all this other stuff? There's no reason for it. I don't see any reason for it.
Paul Beckwith, thank you very much for being on the show and this debate. He's a physicist engineer, part-time professor at the University of Ottawa Laboratory of Paleoclimatology, and is in a PhD program with a focus on abrupt climate system change.
Thank you, Dane. I would be willing to do this any time in any forum that you want. So don't get me wrong on that. I the more it's talked about, the better. So appreciate our discussion today.
Same to you, Paul. I have great respect for you being willing to come on and have this discussion. In regard to the aluminum, we'd have to ask geoengineers like David Keith. And if your listeners search Dane Wigginton, David Keith, they can see David Keith after a 3.5-hour symposium proposing putting 20 million tons of aluminum nanoparticulates in the sky because it has a greater reflectivity than sulfur and a lower coagulation rate. So we would look at the geoengineers as to why they propose using aluminum. That's what's showing up in our tests. So I agree with you, Paul. Horrible idea. And as David Keith admitted in that symposium, no study on human environmental toxicological impact had been done. None. So I'm asking people to research, simply not to believe anything but what they find with their own research, which we try to provide that material at geoengineeringwatch.org. So my thanks to you, Paul, and to you, Jeff, for arranging this discussion.
You bet. Paul, thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. Dane, hold tight, and we'll get the next scientist on for you, okay?